God's Holy Spirit enables us to perceive occurrences of divine intervention. Instances of divine intervention permeate the Bible. According to 2 Timothy 3:16, stories of divine intervention are true and are provided to bring us closer to God. The Living Bible reads, "The whole Bible was given to us by inspiration from God and is useful to teach us what is true and to make us realize what is wrong in our lives. It straightens us out and helps us to do what is right." I'm going to discuss three instances of divine intervention in the Bible, explain how they can help straighten us out and help us do what is right, and relate them to modern times. First, the pillar of cloud. The pillar of cloud is first introduced in Exodus 13, 21, and 22. There are many subsequent references to the cloud throughout Exodus, and in Numbers, Deuteronomy, Nehemiah, Psalms, and 1 Corinthians. Why was the cloud divine intervention? Consider our concept of a cloud today. A visible mass of condensed water vapor floating in the atmosphere, randomly moving wherever the wind pushes it. The cloud in Exodus defies our understanding. It moved with purpose. It could pause at any time and not dissipate or blow away. It could stay in one place for weeks or months at a time. It could even provide protection from enemies. Let's read a little about this amazing cloud. It moved with purpose. Exodus 13:21 states, "The Lord guided them by a pillar of cloud during the daytime and a pillar of fire at night, so they could travel either by day or night. It paused periodically." Numbers 9:17. "When the cloud lifted, the people of Israel moved on to wherever it stopped and camped there." It could stay in one place. Numbers 9:22. "If the cloud stayed above the tabernacle 2 days, a month, or a year, that's how long the people of Israel stayed. But as soon as it moved, they moved. It protected the Israelites." Exodus 14:19-20. "Then the angel of God who was leading the people of Israel moved the cloud around behind them, and it stood between the people of Israel and the Egyptians. And that night, as it changed to a pillar of fire, it gave darkness to the Egyptians, but light to the people of Israel. So the Egyptians couldn't find the Israelites." Verse 24 adds, "Early that morning the Lord looked down from the tall cloud and column of fire at the Egyptian army. Then he made them panic." What happened next was the greatest evacuation in history prior to the 20th century. An entire nation miraculously escaped from an enemy determined to wipe them out. Exodus 14 concludes with this statement, "The Israelites saw the great power of the Lord when he defeated the Egyptians. So the people feared and respected the Lord, and they began to trust the Lord and his servant Moses." But it wasn't just the Israelites that day that learned to fear the Lord. Over 40 years later, what did Rahab confess to the spies? Joshua 2:10-11 says, "We heard how the Lord dried up the Red Sea so you could leave Egypt. And we heard how you destroyed Sihon and Og, those two Amorite kings east of the Jordan River. We know that the Lord your God rules heaven and earth, and we've lost our courage and our will to fight." 1,000 years later, Nehemiah, during a national confession of sin, cited the never-to-be-forgotten Red Sea deliverance, starting with Nehemiah 9:9. You saw the troubles and sorrows of our ancestors in Egypt, and you heard their cries from beside the Red Sea. You displayed great miracles against Pharaoh and his people, for you knew how brutally the Egyptians were treating them. You have a glorious reputation because of those never-to-be-forgotten deeds. You divided the sea for your people so they could go through on dry land. And then you destroyed their enemies in the depths of the sea. They sank like stones beneath the mighty waters. In verse 12, you led our ancestors by a pillar of cloud during the day and a pillar of fire at night so they could find their way. Another 500 years passed when Paul reiterated that the miracle of the Red Sea must always be remembered. 1 Corinthians 10:1. For we must never forget, dear brothers, what happened to our people in the wilderness long ago. God guided them by sending a cloud that moved along ahead of them, and he brought them all safely through the waters of the Red Sea. How does believing and recalling the story of the pillar of cloud help us do what's right? If we'll seek God with all our hearts and soul, God promises, I will guide you along the best pathway for your life. I will advise you and watch over you. Psalm 32:8. And Psalm 91:1 assures us that those who go to God Most High for safety will be protected by God All-Powerful. The escape through the Red Sea occurred about 3,500 years ago. Is there any modern parallel in which God miraculously intervened to save the lives of hundreds of thousands of his people from an enemy determined to wipe them out? Consider Operation Dynamo. On May 10, 1940, Germany invaded Luxembourg, the Netherlands, Belgium, and France. The Germans, using previously unseen tactics that newspapers termed Blitzkrieg or Lightning War, surprised and engulfed their enemies with startling speed. Luxembourg capitulated within a matter of hours on the day of invasion, May 10th. On May 14th, the Netherlands surrendered. Belgium fell on May 28th, and France in June. On May 14th, German panzer divisions shattered French defenses in the Ardennes, enabling the Germans by May 20th to cut off and surround the Allied units that had advanced into Belgium to meet the expected German threat. Surrounded by two massive German armies, the Allies retreated to the French town of Dunkirk, just south of Belgium. The Germans, confident of an overwhelming victory, airdropped leaflets showing a map of the seemingly impossible situation. It read, British soldiers, look at the map. It gives your true situation. You're entirely surrounded. Stop fighting. Put down your arms. The Allied commander on the scene, Lord Gort, had no false illusions about the predicament. From the front, in a letter to the Secretary of State for War, he wrote, I must not conceal from you that a great part of the BEF, the British Expeditionary Force, and its equipment will inevitably be lost in the best of circumstances. And even Prime Minister Churchill later confessed, I feared it would be my hard lot to announce the greatest military disaster in our long history. Had the Germans killed or captured the troops they so adroitly surrounded, the United Kingdom might have had to accept the terms of surrender then offered to them. However, what followed instead, German General Gert von Rundstedt called one of the great turning points of the war. The article, Dunkirk, Divine Deliverance, cites three divine interventions that resulted in the evacuation of 338,226 Allied troops from the seawalls and beaches of Dunkirk between the 9 days of May 27th and June 4th, 1940. The first divine intervention was the incomprehensible order on May 24th to halt the German armored divisions. Quoting from the article, "Even now, historians puzzle over why this happened. Not even the German generals could agree the reason for the call to halt. Whatever the reason was, the three-day respite provided time for several things to unfold. And here are two. On May 24th, King George VI broadcast an appeal for a national day of fasting and prayer on behalf of the British Army in peril in Flanders. In the book, Dunkirk Revisited, John Richardson wrote about the response of the British people on Sunday, May 26th. Every church and synagogue had been packed. Petticoat Lane's market closed for the only time in its history so traders could attend church. On the forecourt of Southampton's Guildhall, an overflow of 2,000 had assembled to hear relayed the united service within. From Westminster Abbey to the perimeters of the UK, from the Archbishop of Canterbury to the newest man of the cloth, ministers prayed for the help of the Almighty to save the British Army. A second thing that unfolded occurred at 10 p.m. on May 25th, when the War Office initiated Operation Dynamo, the evacuation of Dunkirk. By their best estimates, military officials hoped at least 45,000 men could be liberated before the Germans overran the trapped defenders. The Royal Navy had about 220 ships in the channel, but because of the shallow waters around Dunkirk, they couldn't safely approach shore. With help from the Ministry of Shipping, hundreds of civilian small ships with shallow drafts were requisitioned. Ships like the Royal Daffodil, a ferry boat on the River Mersey, to the Tamzin, a fishing boat less than 15 feet long, responded. By May 27th, the first small ships reached the beaches of France. 8,000 men were rescued that day, ferried either to the warships or taken across the channel to Ramsgate. The peak day was May 31st, when 68,000 men were rescued. On June 4th, 26,000 of the rear guard soldiers were evacuated. But Operation Dynamo ended that day when the Germans finally captured Dunkirk and the 30,000 to 40,000 remaining soldiers left behind. The largest evacuation in military history was made possible by two other divine interventions. One was the strangely calm conditions in the channel. The normally heaving and unstable channel waters turned placid through the 9 days of evacuation. If you've ever been on a cruise ship that required tendering to get to shore, you know the difficulty and slowness of moving from one boat to another, and the rougher the sea, the greater the difficulty and the slower the process. Multiply that by 338,226 people, and you can see the blessing of a calm ocean. Writing about the miracle of the still waters, the Daily Telegraph wrote, "Those who are accustomed to the channel testify to the strangeness of this calm. They are deeply impressed by the phenomenon of nature by which it became possible for tiny craft to go back and forth safely. It should be noted that those tiny craft were loaded beyond their manufacturer's safety limits." One sailor recalled, "The little boats listed drunkenly from the weight of the men." Ironically, a third divine intervention at Dunkirk was a great storm inland over Flanders. Bad weather over land gave cover to Allied forces, softened the area marshlands, which severely hampered the German panzers, and grounded the Luftwaffe for all but 2.5 days of Operation Dynamo. The head of the German Army General Staff, General Halder, wrote in his diary on May 30th, "The pocket would have been closed at the coast if only our armor had not held back. The bad weather has grounded the Luftwaffe, and we must now stand and watch countless thousands of the enemy get away to England right under our noses." The lesson of Dunkirk is the same as a lesson from the pillar of cloud. If we seek God with all our heart and soul, He will guide and protect us. Here's an excerpt from the Daily Telegraph of June 8, 1940. The prayers of the nation were answered. The God of hosts Himself had supported the valiant men of the British Expeditionary Force. One thing can be certain about tomorrow's Thanksgiving in our churches. From none will the thanks ascend with greater sincerity or deeper fervor than from the officers and men who have seen the hand of God powerful to save, delivering them from the hands of a mighty foe who, humanly speaking, had them utterly at their mercy. Imagine the emotions and reverence of the choirs and congregations that sang Psalm 124 that day. From the Contemporary English Version, here's Psalm 124. The Lord was on our side. Let everyone in Israel say, the Lord was on our side. Otherwise, the enemy attack would have killed us all because it was furious. Let's praise the Lord. He protected us from enemies who were like wild animals, and we escaped like birds from a hunter's torn net. The Lord made heaven and earth, and He is the one who sends us help. Another example of divine intervention in the Bible came through a dream. Chapters 5 through 8 of Judges tell the story of Gideon. From his calling in chapter 5 through the subduing of the Midianites in chapter 8, Gideon's life abounded with examples of divine intervention. The one I want to focus on is in chapter 7 of Judges. Here, Gideon was preparing for war against the Midianites. In a series of divine interventions, God reduced his army from the original 10,000, or from the original 32,000, to 10,000, to 300. Gideon, until just recently a farmer, wasn't convicted by the plan God laid out for him. So God, in verse 9, told him to sneak into the Midianite camp and listen to what the enemy soldiers were saying. Judges 7, verse 9. That night the Lord said, "Get up, go down into the Midianite camp, for I've given you victory over them. But if you're afraid to attack, go down to the camp with your servant Purah. Listen to what the Midianites are saying, and you will be greatly encouraged. Then you will be eager to attack." What was it that God knew that was happening in the Midianite camp? What was Gideon to listen for? Verse 11 continues the story. So Gideon took Purah and went down to the edge of the enemy camp. The armies of Midian, Amalek, and the people of the east had settled in the valley like a swarm of locusts. Their camels were like grains of sand on the seashore, too many to count. Gideon crept up just as a man was telling his companion about a dream. The man said, "I had this dream. And in my dream, a loaf of barley bread came tumbling down into the Midianite camp. It hit a tent, turned it over, knocked it flat." His companion answered, "Your dream can mean only one thing. God has given Gideon, son of Joash, the Israelite, victory over the Midian, over Midian and all its allies." Verse 15, when Gideon heard the dream and its interpretation, he bowed in worship before the Lord. Then he returned to the Israelite camp and shouted, "Get up, for the Lord has given you victory over the Midianite hordes." Verse 15 shows the effect of the dream on Gideon. Grateful, relieved, and in awe, he silently prayed while still in earshot of the enemy camp. No longer did Gideon doubt that God would destroy the Midianites. The Bible doesn't say exactly what effect the dream had on the Midianites, but it implies that the word of the dream spread quickly throughout the camp, demoralizing and frightening the troops. For when Gideon's 300 men lit their torches and blew their shofars, the Midianites panicked and slaughtered each other in the dark of night. How does believing and recalling the story of the Midianite soldier's dream help us do what's right? If we'll seek God with all our heart and soul, God speaks to us in different ways, sometimes in the night, using terrifying dreams to give us warnings. That's from Job 33:14-16 in the Contemporary English Version. And Psalm 60:12 assures us, with God's help we will do mighty things, for he will trample down our foes. Is there a modern parallel in which a dream changed the outcome of a war? Consider the inspiration for the M9 gun predictor, an electronic analog computer designed for use with anti-aircraft weapons. The author of three discoveries made in dreams called the M9, a gun that helped change the course of World War II. Prior to the M9, here's a quote about the ineffectiveness of anti-aircraft fire from the book The Invention That Changed the World. Existing British meter-wave fire control radars amounted to little more than a prayer. A plane's approximate position was detected. Searchlights were directed in the intruder's general direction. Guns let loose static barrages in the hope a bomber might run into the flak. A newspaper article, Wisconsin Scientist's Dream Weapon, in the May 30, 1945 Milwaukee Journal, was more detailed in the failings of anti-aircraft guns. Suppose your target is a bomber moving at 360 miles an hour at 40,000 feet. It will take a shell nearly 30 seconds to reach that altitude. In this time, a plane will move 3 miles. Therefore, if you were to score a hit, you must not shoot at the plane, but 3 miles ahead of the plane. The article goes on to explain some of the other forces at work that needed to be factored. The rotation of the shell, wind speed, the density of the air, gravity, and the fuse, which times the moment when the shell explodes. The solution to all these factors came from a most unexpected source and in a most unexpected manner. David B. Parkinson and a dream. Mr. Parkinson worked for Bell Labs, the telephone company, in a civilian capacity. At the time of his dream, he was researching a device for producing musical tones by electrical methods. His project included a resistance potentiometer, a device that measured electrical currents. Following the evacuation of Dunkirk in May of 1940, Mr. Parkinson had the most vivid dream of his life. He found himself with a Dutch anti-aircraft gun crew. Every shot they fired from an automated gun downed an enemy plane. After 4 hits, one of the crewmen smiled at him and beckoned at him to look at the equipment, and controlling the AA gun was his potentiometer. Mr. Parkinson awoke with full recollection of his dream. He quickly drew several schematics, which he took to work, and after seeing them, his boss realized the potential of what Mr. Parkinson had envisioned, an electronic brain for a gun. Within weeks, Mr. Parkinson's idea became the foremost project of the labs. Before long, over 500 people, circuit designers, systems engineers, draftsmen, mathematicians, and others, worked day and night to develop a viable prototype, which debuted on April 1, 1942. The next day, the Army ordered 1,256 units. How did the M9 perform in battle? Prior to its deployment, it took about 19,000 rounds of AA shells to down an enemy plane. After its deployment, in one Pacific engagement, 88 shells brought down 12 Japanese Zeros flying at 14,600 feet. At Guadalcanal, an average of 90 shells was needed to down bombers at 30,000 feet. It's believed the Germans ceased bombing the beaches of Anzio due to the accuracy of the M9, which downed nearly 200 planes. And during the Second Battle of Britain, 74 out of every 100 B-1 buzz bombs launched at London were blown out of the sky. After the war, David B. Parkinson received a Medal for Excellence in Science and Technology from the Franklin Institute and the prestigious Medal for Merit, at that time America's highest civilian decoration, from President Truman on April 8, 1947. Let's look at a third example of divine intervention from the Old Testament, a prayer. The story on which I will focus is in 2 Chronicles 13, but we need to read a few previous passages to get relevant background. In chapter 12, the last part of verse 15 states, Rehoboam and Jeroboam were continually at war with each other. Why? Because when Rehoboam assumed kingship after his father Solomon, he chose to tax and burden his people in multiples of what King Solomon had done. 2 Chronicles 10:13 to 15 tells how he responded to the people's request through Jeroboam to lighten up on the harsh labor demands and heavy taxes that Solomon had imposed on them. Over a three-day period, King Rehoboam considered advice from wise elders and foolish peers. His decision begins in verse 13 of 2 Chronicles 10. King Rehoboam did not listen to the advice from the older men, and he was rude to the people. He did what his friends told him to do and said, "My father forced you to work hard, but I will make you work much harder. My father punished you with whips, but I will punish you with whips that have sharp metal tips." So the king did not do what the people wanted. The Lord caused this to happen, and that's a divine intervention, but not the one I want to talk about. He did this in order to keep the promise he made to Jeroboam, son of Nebat, when he sent Ahijah the prophet from Shiloh to speak to him. And the promise God made to Jeroboam to make Jeroboam king over soon-to-be-divided Israel is in 1 Kings 11, another divine intervention, but not the one on which I'm focusing. The result of Rehoboam's decision was the division of the kingdom and civil war. That brings us to chapter 13 and the divine intervention on which I will focus. The chapter begins after Rehoboam's death and with his son Abijah succeeding him as king. In the first year of his reign, verse 2 indicates that war broke out between Abijah and Jeroboam. Verse 3 in the voice identifies the aggressor and the size of the armies involved. Abijah, who initiated the war, had an army of 400,000 heroic men, but he was drastically outnumbered by Jeroboam's army of 800,000 heroic men. Verse 4 shows that Abijah crossed the border into Israel, where in essence he asked Israel to surrender and reunite with Judah. Abijah went to the top of Mount Zemaraim in the hills of Ephraim and shouted, "Listen, Jeroboam, and all you Israelites." Verse 13 indicates that while Abijah argued his case, Jeroboam secretly sent part of his army around behind the men of Judah to ambush them. The next two verses in the contemporary English version read, "Judah's army realized they were trapped, and they prayed to the Lord. The priests blew the signal on the trumpet, and the troops let out a battle cry. Then, with Abijah leading them into battle, God defeated Jeroboam and Israel's army." Verses 16 to 18 reveal who won and why. The Israelites ran away, and God helped Judah's soldiers slaughter 500,000 enemy troops. Judah's army won because they had trusted the Lord God of their ancestors. Five verses, 14 through 18, describe an enormous war. A war that turned in Judah's favor because of divine intervention. Although Judah's army had let down its guard and allowed itself to be surrounded and trapped, it didn't panic. They prayed, relying on God. Then the trumpets bolstered their confidence in God, and their shouts renewed their courage. And in the end, God gave Judah a great victory. How does believing and recalling the story of Abijah's battle with Jeroboam help us do what's right? If we'll seek God with all our heart and soul, God will rescue us from the snares set by our enemies who entrap us. Psalm 91:3. And Psalm 145:18 assures us, The Eternal stays close to those who call on Him, those who pray sincerely. Is there a modern parallel in which prayer preceded God's intervention in a decisive battle? Consider Patton's prayer. On the morning of December 8, 1944, James H. O'Neill, 3rd Army chaplain, received an unexpected phone call. "This is General Patton. Do you have a prayer for weather? We must do something about those rains if we're to win the war." Those rains had plagued the 3rd Army for the past 3 months, and with a major offensive planned for December 19th, would continue to do so. Weathermen saw no possibility of let-up in the foreseeable future. Chaplain O'Neill consulted a few prayer books, but finding no suitable formal prayer, he wrote his own. About 1 hour later, he showed his second draft to General Patton. "Almighty and most merciful Father, we humbly beseech Thee of Thy great goodness to restrain these immoderate rains with which we have had to contend. Grant us fair weather for battle. Graciously hearken to us as soldiers who call upon Thee, that, armed with Thy power, we may advance from victory to victory and crush the oppression and wickedness of our enemies and establish Thy justice among men and nations. Amen." Chaplain O'Neill tried to hide his surprise when General Patton immediately ordered, "Have 250,000 copies printed and see to it that every man in the 3rd Army gets one." Then the general engaged Chaplain O'Neill in a heartfelt discussion about prayer, which Chaplain O'Neill later referred to as a prayer conference. General Patton took the lead. "Chaplain, how much praying is being done in the 3rd Army?" Chaplain O'Neill answered, "I'm afraid to admit it, but I do not believe that much praying is going on. When there is fighting, everyone prays. But now, with this constant rain, when things are quiet, men just sit and wait for things to happen. Prayer out here is difficult. Both chaplains and men are removed from a special building. Prayer to most of them is a formal, ritualized affair. I do not believe that much praying is going on." Chaplain O'Neill waited patiently for General Patton's response, and in part, here's what General Patton said. "Chaplain, I'm a strong believer in prayer. There are three ways that men get what they want: by planning, by working, and by praying. God has His part or margin in everything. That's where prayer comes in. Up to now, in the 3rd Army, God has been very good to us. This is because a lot of people back home are praying for us. But we have to pray for ourselves too. A good soldier is not made merely by making him think and work. There is something in every soldier that goes deeper than thinking or working. It is something that he has built in. It's a world of truth and power that is higher than himself. Great living is not all output of thought and work. A man has to have intake as well. I don't know what you call it, but I call it religion, prayer, or God." The prayer conference continued. General Patton discussed Gideon, the need for the troops to focus more on prayer, and the need for chaplains to encourage the troops to pray. General Patton then requested, "I wish you would put out a training letter on this subject of prayer to all the chaplains. Write about nothing else, just the importance of prayer. If we all pray, it will be like what Dr. Carroll said," and this allusion was to a press quote some days earlier when Dr. Alexis Carroll, a Nobel Prize-winning surgeon, described prayer as one of the most powerful forms of energy man can generate. "It will be like plugging in on a current whose source is in heaven. I believe that prayer completes that circuit. It is power." With that, General Patton arose from his chair, signaling the conference was over. Chaplain O'Neill returned to his field desk and began typing training letter number 5. General Patton read it the following day, and without change ordered it distributed not only to the 486 chaplains attached to the Third Army, but to every organizational commander down to and including the regimental level. 3,200 copies were required. Here are a few lines from training letter number 5, dated December 14, 1944. Chaplains of the Third Army, I would call upon the chaplains and men of the Third United States Army to focus their attention on the importance of prayer. As chaplains, it is our business to pray. We preach its importance. We urge its practice. But the time is now to intensify our faith in prayer, not alone with ourselves, but with every believing man. Gideon of Bible fame was least in his father's house, but he was a mighty man of valor. His strength lay not in his military might, but in his recognition of God's proper claim on his life. Urge all your men to pray, not alone in church, but everywhere. Pray when driving. Pray when fighting. Pray alone. Pray with others. Pray by night. Pray by day. This army needs the assurance and the faith that God is with us. With prayer, we cannot fail. Signed, the Third Army Commander. The December 19th invasion of Germany, for which the prayer cards and training letter were formulated, never happened. On Saturday, December 16th, in one of the greatest intelligence failures of all time, over 300,000 German troops and 1,000 tanks launched a totally unexpected counteroffensive against 83,000 Allied forces thinly spread along an 85-mile-long line. Within hours, that line started to bulge as the unprepared Allies retreated. Part of the German plan was for the 5th Panzer Army to take the pivotal town of Bastogne, Belgium, by noon, Sunday, December 17th. Controlling the critical roads into and out of Bastogne was the heart of the German offensive. At dawn on the 17th, Germans were within 11 miles of Bastogne. What happened next, the siege of Bastogne, was the subject of the book No Greater Valor. The author, Jerome Corsi, wrote the book to make the case that the power of faith in a being supreme to ourselves played a pivotal role in the outcome. Weather was a big factor in the siege. Cold, fog, rain, and snow pummeled the area. Bad weather prevented Allied planes from providing any support or resupply to the troops in Bastogne. By December 22nd, the defenders were out of food, medical supplies, and almost out of ammunition. No break in the weather was forecast for at least 4 more days. General Patton was making military history as the Third Army headed north to reinforce Bastogne, but many doubted if he'd arrive in time. Here are a few lines from No Greater Valor. On December 22nd, troops of the Third Army began advancing north in a raging snowstorm with copies of Patton's prayer for fair weather in their pockets. December 23rd will be remembered all over the Ardennes campaign as the day when the weather broke. As far as Patton was concerned, unpredicted clearing of the weather was proof Chaplain H. O'Neill was in the good graces of God. And later, General Patton decorated Chaplain O'Neill with a Bronze Star for his effectual prayer. U.S. Army meteorologists had no explanation why the weather changed so suddenly and unpredictably, but the sun rose on December 23rd to a frozen landscape. Air resupply of Bastogne was now possible for the first time since the siege began. The lesson of Bastogne is the same as the lesson from Abijah's battle with Jeroboam. If we seek God with all our heart and soul, God will guide and protect us. I called upon the Lord who is worthy of praise, and he saved me from my enemies. Psalm 18:3. The Bible is full of stories of divine intervention. History is full of stories of divine intervention. I spoke about 6, 3 Old Testament and 3 modern history. God used and continues to use divine intervention to prove that he exists, to prove that he's sovereign, and to prove that he loves us. Exodus 29, 45, and 46 in the Contemporary English Version read, I will live among you as your God, and you will know that I am the Lord your God, the one who rescued you from Egypt so that I could live among you. God is in the intervention business today as much as he was thousands of years ago. We're surrounded by occurrences of divine intervention, even if we're not aware of them. Until the kingdom, we won't know all the ways that God has divinely intervened to affect our lives. But there are some divine interventions that we see and experience every day. Forgiveness, which liberates us from sin. Dreams that reveal a coming government of righteousness and peace. And personal intervention when we receive answers to prayer. We can and do know that God's Spirit directs us in the way he wants us to go. As Psalm 48:14 says, this God is our God forever and ever. He will lead us from now to the end of time.